Politicians in Parliament practice it, physicians prescribe it, and businesses send their staff on courses to learn how to do it. Mindfulness crops up in all sorts of places these days. I'm Roy Jenkins, and on All Things Considered today, we explore this most fashionable phenomenon. What is mindfulness? How do you practice it? What difference can it make? And as a discipline with roots in ancient Buddhism and links with other traditions, to what extent does its current practice require any religious affiliation? To discuss these issues, I'm joined by four guests. In Bangor is Rebecca Crane, who directs the Centre for Mindfulness Research and Practice at Bangor University. She has a particular interest in how mindfulness might help people with recurrent mental illness. On the phone is Father Roger Dawson, a Jesuit priest and director of St. Bino's Ignatian Spirituality Centre in Denbighshire. He's a former army infantry officer and is a trained clinical psychologist. Elora Finlay, Baroness Finlay of Llandaff, a world expert in palliative medicine, regularly attends Parliament's mindfulness sessions, and she's in our Milbank studio. And sitting opposite me here in Llandaff is Vishwapani from the Cardiff Buddhist Centre, who's practiced mindfulness and meditation since he was a teenager and taught them for over 20 years. Welcome to you all. Rebecca, let's start with you. Basic definitions. What is mindfulness?
Mindfulness is a way of connecting with and seeing clearly what is happening in our lives. At its very simplest form, it's a form of awareness that we cultivate through meditation practices.
But how does someone practice mindfulness? How?
So we practice mindfulness through meditating. So we deliberately take some time out of our everyday life to sit quietly with ourselves and to train our attention to be able to rest with different aspects of our experience.
So these are mental exercises or spiritual exercises or physical exercises?
I would say mental exercise is probably the nearest one of those three that you just cited. It's really is a way of very deliberately cultivating our capacity to pay attention and to pay attention in a kindly, compassionate way.
But what's the point?
The point is that as humans, we're very often not present in our lives. We're often caught up in thinking about the future or the past. We can fail to notice what's good in our lives. We can ignore what our bodies are telling us. We get caught up in toxic self-criticism. And this mindfulness is a way of being able to see clearly these patterns, these habits, and to make clearer choices about how we move with our lives, how we are with our own experience.
Elora, you've been going to mindfulness courses in Parliament the past year or so. Now, what's been the attraction for you?
I think the attraction for us all in Parliament is that we're so busy rushing around with so many pressures on us of different bits of legislation and always feeling you need to be in two places at once. And actually, that makes one very inefficient. And by slowing down, by just taking a moment, you sort of recharge your own batteries. You get calmer, you can then be more organised, and bizarrely, you can be more efficient.
And has it actually made a difference to the way in which you do your work?
Oh, it's made a huge difference,
really?
Actually. It's made a difference because when I've had things that have been pressurising and difficult outside work, I've been able to let that tension down rather than it spill over into other things I'm doing. It's terribly easy, isn't it, for all of us to have things go wrong at home, to have worries and anxieties, to feel devastated by something. And that comes across as being tetchy and irritable and short with other people, whereas actually we have to keep that in a compartment and we have to be able to say, but it's okay, that's happening, or that's happened, and now this is the job in hand, and I need just to get through this, and then I can return to the other. But if you're not able to calm down, what happens is all the different bits spill over. So while you're worrying about a family member, you're worrying about a piece of legislation, and vice versa.
Yeah. So, Vishwapani, here's someone practicing mindfulness, and in a very secular context. But of course, as I've said, it has its roots in the Buddhist tradition, and there are other religions which also have elements of this as well. How important are these religious roots to you?
Well, I recognise everything that Elora has said as part of the kind of mindfulness I try to practice in my own life. So that secular perspective is definitely embedded there within what I would see as a broader context. Partly that's Buddhist, but partly we need to understand that the mindfulness that's being taught at the moment really focuses around short courses, usually lasting 8 weeks, whereas mindfulness has always been seen as a lifelong practice. So not surprisingly, as you continue in time, all sorts of different areas of your life come into focus. And the area of sharing practice with other people is very important. And that's one of the things that community and a religious community can give you. But the other context is, I suppose, the more fundamental existential questions that we all face as human beings. You know, what does it mean to be alive, to have suffering in our lives, to grow old, to die? And the awareness that we're cultivating with mindfulness has a place within that as well.
But what is distinctive about Buddhist practice of mindfulness?
Well, as a Buddhist, I suppose one dimension of my Buddhist practice is what grows naturally out of what I can experience from what's happened already to me in the past. And another dimension comes from opening oneself to a vision of existence, a vision of life, and a vision of what it is to be human that isn't already present within my own experience. That I take from the Buddhist teachings, which we call the Dharma.
Right. Now then, Roger Dawson, to what extent does any of this resonate with the Christian faith as far as you're concerned?
Well, an awful lot. I mean, I think this has been part of the Christian tradition really since going back to the Desert Fathers in the 3rd and 4th century. And it's certainly very present in the monastic tradition of contemplative prayer. It is very much present in the Christian tradition, but I think what differs is that it's not really a technique in the Christian tradition, and there is a, you know, there's a referent. It's a prayer to God. It's not me focusing on myself. It's about me going beyond myself, really, and there's an element of self-forgetfulness that should be present in it as well.
But you quote the Desert Fathers from Egypt, from Syria, or whatever. You quote the monastic tradition. Is it within the Christian tradition something for specialists, or is it intended to be what every Christian believer, to some extent, should be pursuing?
Ideally, yes, but I think that it is often quite difficult for a lot of practicing Christians to find out about the richness of this tradition, and it's partly why we have places like St. Bino, so that people can come and experience some of that and grow and deepen in their knowledge and maybe find different ways of praying from the ones that they've grown up with. But it's certainly very present. I mean, there's a fellow Jesuit from the 18th century who wrote a book called The Sacrament of the Present Moment. And in many ways, you know, the present moment is all that we've got. And, you know, the tradition says that we leave the future to God's providence and the past to God's mercy, and with gratitude for the good that we have received both in the present and in the past.
Well, if it is in reality, since it is in reality an ancient discipline, why has it not been more widely recognised or practised inside and outside faith communities, Rebecca?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, I myself grew up in a Christian context, and the first time that I encountered teachings from a mindfulness tradition, I was really lit up because I was hearing something that felt very new, or that it was a very fresh way of receiving these understandings. But I guess, you know, it just seems really important in the way that mindfulness is being translated into a form that is accessible in secular contexts, that in a way any unnecessary impediments for people who are suffering and are seeking release and relief from suffering are not placed in the way.
So does this mean, Vishwapani, that really it's a sort of spiritual exercise without the baggage of formal religion, you know, that the God element's been removed, and that's a good marketing device, really, I suppose, a repackaging and a secularising in order to make it more appealing?
Well, it is that. It is something that's available to people in a way that many of the traditional forms of religious practice aren't, I think. A friend of mine in California is a Jewish Buddhist, a very experienced Zen Buddhist, who is involved in a movement of Jewish renewal because the Judaism that comes through the Hebrew language isn't really accessible to people. But what is relevant is what's going on in my experience right now. So I think there's been, just to give another context, I think one reason this has happened is to do with the history of Buddhism arriving in the West. Now, that's a tradition that does speak about the mind, but doesn't, in quite the same way that Western traditions do, talk about experience of the mind in terms of belief and in terms of those metaphysical assumptions. So Buddhism's arrived in the West over the last 50 years. The key person is Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was a practitioner of Buddhism in America, and he started something called mindfulness-based stress reduction in 1979, trying to offer what he'd learned on the meditation cushion to people in chronic care situations.
Ilora, you've told us why you found the sessions that are held in Parliament useful. Looking around you in those sessions with your colleagues, do you get the impression that most of them are there for the same reason as yourself?
I think that we're there because it's a safe environment, and because we're only peers and MPs, we know that we're so vulnerable to what the outside world says and wants to say about us, but it creates a safe environment in which to reflect and practice mindfulness. I think one of the problems that has happened over the years is a sense that religion does to you, and that actually often in the Christian tradition, people have been brought up with a sense of sin and somehow being bad, and that they should be seeking forgiveness from their sins. And what this is doing is it's actually putting you in control of your own physiology. When you're tense and anxious, your heart races, you breathe faster, your muscles get tense. And what this is doing is actually slowing you down. It's putting you in control of your own physiology to clear away all those clouding, scrambled thoughts that come in like extraneous crackling noises. And actually, when your mind wanders, you learn to gently and kindly bring your thoughts back to where you are now. And what it does is it actually allows you to appreciate the now. You know, we're type A personalities, by and large, politicians, we all want to be in control of things. And yet most things in life, all the things that really matter, we don't have any control over at all. We don't decide when we're going to be ill. It just happens to us. We don't decide that we're going to have a road accident. The tragedy happens. So this is a way of saying, actually, I'm in control of those physiological processes that I need to be able to cope with what has happened to me.
I'm wondering though, Roger, I mean, Ilora mentioned Christian teaching about sin and all the rest of it. That's not all of Christian teaching, it's a part of it. I mean, do you accept in any sense that it is traditional Christian teaching which is responsible for many people getting messed up and therefore requiring this sort of thing?
Yeah, I think people like me are to blame for people being badly instructed. But, I regret to say that Laura's understanding is not what I would wish to discover about the Christian faith. Sin would be that this is really about relationships, and that that there is something that goes very badly wrong in our relationships, and particularly in our relationship with God. And so sin is no more, no less than what separates us from God. And I think that the Christian understanding is not simply that we're bad, it's that we do mess up, and we can mess up quite badly, but we're loved and forgiven. And so what we're trying to do is hold together three things of being a loved and forgiven sinner. But of all those, the context for that is love and being loved.
Can I come back in? Because I think there's something about an external locus of control, though, for people who don't have a faith, that they feel that, why do you believe in this thing, whatever it is called, God as a deity, which in an odd way does to you, and they, those who don't have a faith, want to have some way of having a locus of control. And by pulling the locus of control within yourself, but in a calming way, it can be positive rather than destructive, which is what happens in so many people's lives.
Sure. But what's interesting is that the research in psychology of religion shows that those religious people who have an internal locus of control, including Christian people, are those who have have better outcomes on health and probably what we describe as a healthier form of religious belief. So Christians can be have both internal and external locus of control. And every time we're talking about God, we have to ask somebody, well, what's your image of God?
If you just joined us, you're listening to All Things Considered on BBC Radio Wales, and we're discussing mindfulness. Shivapani, we've talked about some of the ways in which mindfulness is being used these days in business, in education, in health. And indeed, I read an article where someone was saying this is the key to success. Now, as far as you're concerned, how important is the motivation for practicing this stuff?
Well, the motivation is going to be fundamental to the outcome. If you want to be a, if somebody's better at making money, then you can no doubt use mindfulness as a technique, stripped of all values and contexts, that will help you do that. But I would hope, and this is only a hope, and we have to see really how this all works out, that bringing that kindly, open, sensitive, genuine attention to one's thoughts, one's patterns, one's habits, and one's motivations will actually have a benign effect in changing them for the better.
Rebecca?
Well, I think that there is a real challenge for us working within this field. So within the Buddhist context for mindfulness practice, there is a very strong ethical framework, which is explicit. And within the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction, these eight-week courses that are offered in secular contexts, there is a very strong ethical basis to this work, but it is implicit. So it really rests on the teacher and their own personal development and the way in which they're conducting themselves and the process of the teaching. So there's something I think very important about how the ethical part of this comes through in the teaching process.
But Rebecca, how can you teach something as big as mindfulness on an eight-week course? I mean, you know, do your 8 weeks and you've done it then. You know, you've qualified. You are now a mindful person. I mean, isn't it an ongoing process?
Very much so. I mean, I'm always bowled over by the changes that people do make within their lives in eight short weeks. It's an intense 8 weeks. People are practicing a lot. So they're doing 45 minutes of meditation practice each day. So it's it often creates for people a kind of memory bank of experience which they can draw on going forward.
But it is
only the beginning.
But do they then have to keep coming back for top-ups?
Yes. I mean, the human mind has a continual tendency to stray.
Yeah. Rebecca, I think there's a challenge here for people in the mindfulness world because we do tend to focus on the introductory eight-week course. And I think, you know, in conjunction with people like Buddhists and perhaps Jesuits and so on, we really need to be building a mindfulness culture, taking mindfulness in all sorts of directions beyond the 8 weeks.
So does that mean, therefore, that it is inadequate simply to regard mindfulness as something that is an individual pursuit, that it has, in some sense, to relate to a community? There has to be some sort of support network. It has to be lived out in a community. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think pragmatically, people get on better if their friends are doing this with them, if they can share things. I don't know how you construct a community around something that doesn't have a core set of, something beyond the community in its own right. But we can, I think we're starting to see mindfulness spreading further and further. And yeah, go on, Roy.
Yeah, but no, I'm just thinking, I mean, I'm wondering what Roger thinks about this. I mean, much of what we've heard is, you could say, well, speaking from a sort of a Christian position, here are people who are, if you will, to use this language, coming to faith and learning some basic stuff about the faith. Yeah. But always then there will be the teaching in certainly Christian churches of all sorts that I'm aware of. You can only continue in this, you can only develop, you can only grow in this, insofar as you're in relation to other people who are about the same process.
Well, it seems to me that what mindfulness does is confront the fact of that we live in a mindless world and that we're mindless a lot of the time. And often we're investing in things that aren't very important, we're worrying about things that don't matter, and we're chasing things that ultimately won't satisfy us. And I think that what it does, I would want to introduce the element of silence into this, that it isn't simply the fact of attentional control, which is difficult, and focusing our attention and being mindful and being in the present moment. But I think that if we open up the possibility of silence or the reality of silence, that places us at the threshold of our soul. And you know, there are people on retreat here at St. Bino's at the moment who are halfway through an 8-day silent retreat, and the only time that they will talk will be 45 minutes a day when they see their spiritual director. And if we pay attention to experience, this is the tradition of the Jesuits, if we pay attention to experience and we are silent and we are still, then something good will happen there, and something of God will happen, and that will be good for us, and it'll change us for the better.
Does that?
So I would see it as mindfulness is, it puts you on a threshold. It can start you on a journey. Now, where that journey goes, I'm not really sure.
Does that therefore mean, Ilora, that as far as you're concerned, that being mindful has very strong ethical implications, that perhaps mindfulness should sometimes disturb you as well as quietening you down, that it should sort of sharpen your conscience about things?
Yes, I would completely agree. It sharpens your awareness of other people. And instead of being focused all the time on yourself and the way that they react, it's also to think about, well, what is your behaviour doing to them in that relationship? And what is your obligation to others? And so to be less judgmental, actually, to be more tolerant, and to be more broad-minded, I think, and more understanding.
Because, Vishwapana, you teach all sorts of people this, and some of the people are being sent by their firms, by their employers and all the rest of it. Is there any evidence at all from the stuff that you've done with folk that they've actually started questioning deeply the basis of what they're doing? That perhaps some of the way in which their employers are acting, they are acting in relation to their employers, ought to be challenged? Do you get any of that?
Yes, because when you're in a state of real distress, feeling stressed, feeling anxious, feeling depressed, you're experiencing the consequences of all of the things that have influenced you. Some of them we can talk about psychologically. They're the ways you've responded to what's happened. Some of them are about the pressures that have come to you from the outside. And I do see people reflecting, if this is how my job has made me feel, what the hell am I doing in my job?
Rebecca, you have particular interest in research measuring the practical effects of mindfulness, and you especially concerned with people with mental illness. Now, I mean, are you able to sort of summarise the sort of the practical effects which you've seen?
Research has consistently demonstrated over the last, since 2000, the first research study on mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was published, which demonstrated that depression rates are reduced by between 40 and 50% in those who are most vulnerable to recurrent depression. And there's been a number of trials since then, which have helped us to shape and refine our understanding of how this works and which particular groups of people seem to be most helped by this. So we know now that those people whose depression comes out of childhood trauma are most helped by mindfulness-based cognitive therapy.
And how robust is this research? Because, I mean, there are often criticisms that the promoters of mindfulness actually overclaim its effectiveness and that their evidence is actually inadequate.
The research trials that I'm reporting on here have really very strong governance, and they're independently checked. They're randomised controlled trials in which the researchers are blind to which side of the trial the participants are engaged on. So there's a huge amount of checks in the system to ensure that the results are really telling us what they're telling us.
Roger, we've been using the term almost interchangeably, meditation and mindfulness. But I'm wondering to what extent mindfulness has different goals from classical meditation.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've found in some of the mindfulness work that I've done is that it can end up with me focusing on me, and rather than me placing myself in the presence of God or entering into a conversation with Jesus. And so I suppose I find it extremely useful for grounding myself, for getting out of doing mode and into being mode. But as I say, I find that it places me on the threshold of something to open up into something much, much bigger. I was talking to somebody recently, a clinical psychologist with a lot of experience in mindfulness, who's also a practicing Catholic, and he said that in his work with NHS staff, he said, what tends to happen is they get in touch with something that is bigger than themselves, and they find that that is good, and they want to stay in touch with it. Mm. Now, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think that that is something of the consolation of God. And I'm very glad that people are getting in touch with something like that, though they may never actually name it.
A final question for each of you, a very brief answer, if I may. If it were to be the case that all of us were to take up mindfulness from today and go on a course and then commit ourselves to it, what difference would it make to us? Rebecca?
There would be a number of things. The thing that came to my mind most immediately when you said that was that we would have a much greater sense of how each one of us is totally interconnected with everybody else in this world, so that the way that we think and the way that we act really influences the world.
Vishwapani?
One of the reasons that mindfulness has really exploded is to do with the way our society is changing. It's becoming faster and faster, more focused on doing and competing and so on and so forth. People are being attracted to mindfulness because we want something to go against that. If everyone did it, we would have a different society.
Roger.
I think we would be more attentive to what is real and truthful. And I think we would be more compassionate with ourselves and with other people.
And the last word to the House of Lords.
Thank you. I think it's important to remember that the past is something we can learn from. The moment is now. We need to hold it with, if you like, reverence and responsibility. Think about it, and then we can move forward positively in our own lives and in the lives of others we touch. And I would say, in this busy world where one might say one's too busy to do this, I would say, you're so busy, can you afford to not slow down and reflect?
Ilora Finlay, Vishwapani, Rebecca Crane, Roger Dawson, many thanks. If you'd like to hear this programme again or download the podcast, you can do so via our webpage at bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales. All Things Considered will be here at the same time next week. But meanwhile, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.
Your weekend with BBC Radio Wales. A String of Pearls, part of your weekend with BBC Radio Wales.